Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, a look at new technology for pulp and paper mills. Dr. Ted Garver has spent the last few years trying to get stickies out of the papermaking process, and by George, he's done it. And you'll meet Dr. Sun Kwok. This University of Calgary astronomer has just launched a satellite, and this is but one of many projects that's turning Calgary into NASA North. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. White water is great if you love canoeing. It's terrible if you're making paper. When you've got white water in your pulp stream, it means you've got too much sticky stuff from trees, and that's going to gum up your equipment, ruin your paper, and cost you lots of money. Dr. Ted Garver of the Alberta Research Council has spent the better part of his career researching problems in the pulp and paper process. When a mill in Ontario asked for help to get them out of a sticky situation, he came up with a solution that boosted the mill's papermaking efficiency to almost 100%. The technology Ted developed is now marketed by Aquantix, the Whitewater Instruments Group at the Alberta Research Council.
The problem with the water in a pulp and paper mill, for example, is there accumulates a soup of wood extractives and carbohydrates and other components from the wood that impair the performance of the equipment, the paper machines, the other pulp processing machines, or also lead to increased chemical cost in the processing of the pulp and paper. What we're interested in is in managing those substances, like a pitch you would see dripping off a pine tree. Those substances get in the water and impair the performance. We're looking at measuring those and controlling those substances in order to improve the pulping and papermaking efficiency.
Well, when I think of a pitch, I think of it as being a really gummy kind of substance. So is that what it does to the machines? Does it gum it up and bring everything to a screeching halt?
Yeah, absolutely, it does. It's another word that's sometimes used in the pulp and paper industry is stickies. And the pitch can have a variable stickiness depending on what what the history of that pitch has been in the water, and what are the other chemicals that have been added. In fact, there's a whole chemical industry based on making sure that the pitch that's in water is not sticky and doesn't deposit onto the paper machines and pulp processing equipment.
Well, can't you just skim it off and get rid of it?
No, these substances are finely dispersed in the water. We call the white water that's used for processing pulp and paper white water, and that's because this pitch is very finely dispersed. These are particles that are between 0.1 micron and 2 microns. In other words, they're very, very small, around the same dimensions as a wavelength of light, and that's why they scatter light, they appear white, and that's how the term white water came about.
So the water itself, does it just go through the process and out, or is it reused?
No, part of the advantage of our instruments and one of our objectives is to use the water as many times as possible. Typically, water is used in a pulp and paper mill up to 20 times. Any time you've sent water to the effluent pond, before that, you've wasted water. And one of our objectives is to maximize the use of the water, and so the mills can use less water while still having the same efficiency as they're used to.
So you've had this problem of trying to get the sticky stuff out of the water. What have you actually done then over the past few years to deal with that problem? What's your work or your research been?
the problem really, as we saw it, was there wasn't a means to measure the stability of the pitch, the concentration of the pitch, or the effect of adding a chemical to either disperse the pitch or coagulate the pitch. We had no measurements of all of those things. And so we developed these measurements and then moved on to ruggedizing the instruments, and so they could be left running in a pulp and paper mill day in and day out for years.
What do these instruments look like that you've developed, and whereabouts are they in the process?
Well, the instruments tend to be housed in kind of a big box. We call it a NEMA 4 box. I can actually spray it down with a fire hose. The inside the instruments are much more delicate components that measure light in a variety of ways. After we've sampled or manipulated the sample by filtering it at different levels, or also we change the temperature of the sample. And so we have a number of tricks that we do to get the water to give up its information about the chemical composition and the physical properties.
Well, you say tricks. What are some of these tricks?
Well, the tricks are, for example, we measure the light at a bunch of different wavelengths and also at a bunch of different temperatures. What happens there is the pitch particle actually changes size, and some of the components come off into the water. And so this changes how the water absorbs and scatters light.
What have been some of the problems that you've had to deal with as you've gone through this research and development?
One of the things that we worked on for a long time was a method to filter the water more or less constantly for months and months on end without the filters plugging up. Of course, this is part of the problem with the with these substances, is that they tend to plug filters. That's why we're in business. That's why we're trying to invent things. And so we had to go through many different permutations of getting the filter right, and so we could reliably get a sample for our light measurement. There were some other problems. Some of them come down to simply engineering a system in order to get rugged components, or a system that communicates well with the computer systems that run pulp and paper mills.
What you've done is you've developed instruments that can give you a sense of what's in the water, where the pitch is, or how much is there. But then if it's in the water at that point, what can you do with it, even though you've measured it?
There's quite a bit we can do with it. And if you've ever been to a pulp and paper mill, it is one huge labyrinth of pipes. And there's water going everywhere. And like I say, it's been used many times. And so there's quite a bit of fine-tuning that you can do with just the flow of water in the mill. There's also chemical control. And typically what we want to do is, if there's problems related to the dissolved and colloidal, those are the particle size components, in the water, we like to leave those problems with the substances as far back in the process as we can. And so the chips come in and they're washed, and then we pulp, and then it's washed more, and then the pulp moves slowly towards the paper machine. The more we can leave that water back towards the front end of the process, the better. And I think that's largely what it's about. Sometimes it can turn into a very lengthy process that involves capital improvements, installation of dewatering equipment, installation of heat exchangers. Sometimes some of the piping needs to be redone, and almost always the flow of water and standard operating procedures need to be reviewed.
So what have you found really exciting in the development and research of this?
what we've seen that once we managed to get the instruments online, we found that they were not only as important as we found, but actually much more important, in that we found that the dissolved substances were contributing really dramatically to the physical properties, in particular to the drainage and also to the tendency for deposition on the paper machine. I think for me it's really quite gratifying to be able to show a graph of the dissolved solids going up and down in a paper mill, and along with another graph of one of the effects, whether it's being a drainage rate or the brakes or something else, and have somebody who's been running a paper machine for a long, long time look at you in surprise, and actually some small amount of joy anyway, that he's now got a better understanding of the process.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Dr. Ted Garver is a senior scientist at the Alberta Research Council. The whitewater instrumentation technology that he developed has tremendous potential for the pulp and paper industry, as well as other industries. The person in charge of commercializing the technology for the Alberta Research Council is Rick Bromland.
At the moment, our clients are mills that exist in Western Canada. Obviously, our best friends are those that are nearby, such as Alberta Newsprint and Whitecourt and some of the Miller Western mills in the region. We've also been at a mill in British Columbia, and as Ted indicated, have spent a lot of time at a mill in Ontario. It's really been a driver for bringing the technology to where it is now.
From an economic and a business point of view, what does this mean to the people who are running their mills? How do they look at this?
This company will enable mills to reduce the amount of chemicals they use, reduce the amount of off-spec production that's created because of process upsets, and reduce the equipment fouling that can happen. That can translate into hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. One day worth of off-spec production can cost a mill $60,000. If you can save 10% of the amount of chemical that's used in controlling their pitch, that can be $200,000 a year. So there's lots of economic return for mills to implement these systems.
This technology was designed for pulp and paper mills, but are there other applications?
Absolutely. Inside the Research Council, this is called a platform technology, because it inherently has uses in a variety of different ways. There are a number of industries in particular that have challenges in managing dissolved solids and challenges in managing the concentration and stability of some of the colloid materials. The big one that interests me is the food and beverage industry. You know, I'm looking for the first opportunity to go into a brewery and see how this thing is going to pan out. But virtually any industry that is water intensive has applications that these instruments can be applied to, and that's one of the reasons that the potential was so compelling for the Research Council to create a spin-off company.
So where do you see it going now?
Up. Yeah, onward and outward. It's just a terrific business opportunity surrounding this instrumentation.
Is this generally the way the Research Council operates?
Well, they do a variety of things. Certainly the emphasis of the Research Council is to solve practical problems for industry. It's to work at the world-class end of the spectrum in terms of research and development. Sometimes they license the technology, and more recently, in order to build more value and to build Alberta industry, they're moving in the direction of creating spin-off companies or partnerships with Alberta businesses, and this is a prime example of that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Rick Bromland, business manager of Aquantix, the Whitewater Instruments Group at the Alberta Research Council. Before that, I spoke with Dr. Ted Garver, a senior scientist with the ARC and the inventor of the whitewater instrumentation technology. And just yesterday, Ted learned he was the winner of the John S. Bates Award for the best research paper on his whitewater sensors. Coming up, the launching of the Odin satellite. While Alberta is making a name for itself in all kinds of new technology, you'll probably still be surprised to discover we're at the forefront of space research. The University of Calgary is home to the Institute for Space Research, and among the group of internationally renowned scientists working there is astronomer Dr. Sun Kwok. For the last decade, Sun Kwok has been involved in the development of an astronomical satellite that will search for oxygen and water molecules in deep space. Odin, named after the Norse god, was launched 4 weeks ago in Svobodny, Russia. Partners in the Odin project include Sweden, Finland, France, and Canada.
The satellite idea originated in Sweden in 1991, and we in Canada got involved in it shortly afterwards. The idea was to put some very high-frequency radio receivers in space with the scientific purpose of trying to detect water and oxygen molecules in the universe. And as you know, water and oxygen are two of molecules which are important to our everyday life. But unfortunately, we have a hard time seeing these molecules from Earth-based telescopes because our Earth atmosphere is also made up of the same kind of molecules, and they absorb all the light from these molecules coming from space. So in order for us to find these molecules, we have to put a satellite. Put a telescope in a satellite in space.
Now, what's special about this particular project?
Well, this is significant for Canada because this is the first astronomical satellite that Canada has played a significant role in terms of design, construction, and operations. Now, both the Americans and Europeans have launched a number of astronomical satellites. The most high profile, of course, is the Hubble Space Telescope. But for us, this is really the first time that we got our hands dirty, so to speak, that we are a partner in such a project.
You do have a number of partners, Sweden and France and Canada. What is the contribution of all the different countries?
Yeah, this project is really led by Sweden. I mean, they provided most of the cost, and then Canada, France, and Finland are smaller partners. So each country responsible for various components of the satellite. In the case for us at the University of Calgary, we have participated in the optical designs of the radiometer payload, and we also involved in the testing. These are done by our project engineer, Dr. Toczynski, and also software development in terms of control of the scientific observing program done by Dr. Volk. And both Dr. Volk and Dr. Toczynski are now in Sweden. They are monitoring the performance of the satellite, and we are quite happy that we have played a useful role in the whole international project.
This is the sort of thing that doesn't happen overnight. I understand that you've spent a decade getting ready for this one launch. What's involved? Why does it take so long?
Well, first of all, we have to find the money, which is the most important step. I mean, in 1991, I was contacted by the our Swedish colleagues, and I was excited about the possibility of putting a what we call a submillimeter telescope in space, which is something very new at the frontier of astronomy. So I approached the Canadian Space Agency and tried to get them interested and fund this project. And the Canadian Space Agency has been extremely supportive to us, and in 1994, Canada signed an agreement with the Canadian Space Agency signed an agreement with Sweden, and so that began our official participation in this project. So after that, and we began to work on various both scientific and technical aspects of the mission, and these space projects take a long time, because we have to ensure that the space, the components are working well before we put them up, because once they are up in orbit, there's nothing we can do to fix anything that goes wrong.
How is it working so far?
Well, the launch was on February the 20th, and in the past week, various components are gradually being turned on and tested, and as far as we can tell, we are quite optimistic at this time that things are working well.
You were just showing me a picture of a model of inside the satellite, and I was just amazed at how you have to fit everything together. Obviously, that's been a challenge, trying to design all of that. How does that actually work? Can you describe it for me?
Yeah, because in order to minimize the cost of the launch, the payload has to be in a compact configuration, and also we are concerned about the weight and also concerned about energy consumption. So a lot of these factors have to be taken into consideration. And for example, our engineer, Dr. Toczynski, has played a very important role in terms of doing the optical design of the scientific payload.
What's special about the technology that's being used in this particular satellite?
Yeah, this in many ways is the first, because there are four very high frequency receivers on board, and it's the first tunable radio receivers of such a high frequency that have been flown in space. That, to put it into everyday context, the frequencies that are being used are from 500 to 600 gigahertz, which is about 1,000 times higher than commercial TV frequency, and still a few hundred times higher than the high frequencies being used in cellular phones today. So very much so, this represents an important step in terms of radio technology, and hopefully in 30 years or 50 years, this kind of technology would be applied for commercial use in our everyday lives.
Now, this satellite is not the only space research that you've been involved in. I understand that you've been doing some work with the Hubble Telescope and also some other research. Tell me first about your work with the Hubble Telescope.
Yes, I'm interested in the death process of stars. For example, a star like the Sun will have another 5 billion years of its life left. But after that, it will undergo very rapid evolution. And in particular, the last couple thousand years, it would enter into a very magnificent display of color. And we want to find out about the process of how stars die, and we look at other stars which are now at this time of their evolution. And with the Hubble Space Telescope, it allows us to take very high quality pictures of stars at that part of their lives. And in the past several years, we have a number of programs allocated to us to use the Hubble Space Telescope, and we took some magnificent pictures of stars at the end of their lives. And I think that these kind of pictures make a huge difference in our understanding of the last stages of a star's life.
What exactly did you find out?
Well, it's a complicated long story because, for example, 20 years ago, people thought that stars would explode when they die, through many years of research, we found that that is not the case. In fact, it's a more gradual process, but the process itself is interesting. You eject matter in terms of gases, material, molecules, and dust particles into the star surroundings, and this ejection allowed the star to reduce its weight over a very short period of time, and that process allowed the star to avoid the fate of an explosion. So what we are finding in a short sentence is that most of the stars, in fact, we now believe that 95% of stars will not explode, and that is a significant discovery on our understanding of stellar evolution.
It's not easy to get time on the Hubble telescope. How did you manage that?
Well, we are pleased that we have some experience and expertise which are recognized by the Space Telescope Science Institute. I think on the average, the number of proposals submitted, only 1/10 of all the proposals are accepted for time or location.
So do you actually have to compete to get on there?
Yes, the NASA every year conducts a competition process, and astronomers all over the world send in their ideas in the form of very detailed proposals to how they would like to use the telescope, and we are very fortunate that we have been successful quite a few times.
Now, I'm really curious about how it is that so much interest in space is generated here out at the University of Calgary. You walk around the campus, I don't see any rocket sites or telescopes or anything like that. How is it that the people like yourselves actually work and get all of this stuff done, and it has such international importance?
Oh, wow, this is something that we are really proud of. I mean, over the years, they built up a very strong group in the form of the Space Astronomy Laboratory at the University of Calgary, and we have had observing programs on many satellites. For example, Dr. Leahy, Dennis Leahy, who is an expert in X-ray astronomy, he has done many observations in the X-ray from Japanese and European American satellites, and Dr. Wok and myself are interested in the infrared, so we have done observations from infrared telescopes, for example, the infrared astronomical satellite, which was launched in the early 1980s, and I already mentioned that after the Hubble Space Telescope was launched, we did a fair amount of work with that, and later with the Infrared Space Observatory. So we basically have taken on the approach that we want to concentrate on space observations. I mean, other Canadian universities have stronger programs, for example, in ground-based observations, but this is what we specialized in, and I think we have a pretty good track record in this area.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
I was speaking with Dr. Sun Kwok, a professor of astronomy and a deep space explorer at the University of Calgary. Sun has a book on astrophysics which will soon be published by Cambridge University Press. You can look for it at Amazon.com. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. I welcome your comments and suggestions. Send me an email when you visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producers for Innovation Alberta are Scott Franchuk and Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.